This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. Breaking news tonight, a deal with the devil. Brian Koberger gets a plea deal. What does it mean? No death penalty. What did the families of the victims learn? Everything contained in a letter. Are you kidding me? They find out about the deal with the devil by letter?
911 location of your emergency.
Oh my God, something is happening. Something is happening in our house. We don't know what. She's not waking up. They saw some man in their house last night.
What happened that night at the King Road address where four beautiful University of Idaho students were stabbed dead? Now, we will never know. The audacity of taking a plea deal with the devil, Brian Koberger, without the family's consent. I've never heard anything like it. With me, an all-star panel to make sense of what we are learning right now, but I got to tell you, I'm crushed. And I can only imagine what the victims' families are going through. You know, I thought I knew it all about grieving and mourning and suffering when my fiancé was murdered shortly before our wedding. But now that I have two children, nothing could be worse than this being done to your child. And then you have no voice at all about a plea deal. Is this America? How has this happened? Does the prosecutor not hear the crying, the wails of the victims' families? With me, a loyal and all-star panel that has analyzed, examined, investigated this case from day one. Straight out to Dave Mack, Crime Stories investigative reporter. Dave, I can't believe this. I cannot believe this. I feel like I've been kicked in the stomach and in the teeth at the same time. I expect shenanigans on the part of the defense. I expect that there can be one bad apple on the police force or on the investigation team. But this, for the prosecutors to go behind the victims' families' back and offer a plea deal to Brian Koberger. What happened, Dave Mack?
Well, Nancy, it looks like after the defense laid out their possible alternative suspects idea and the judge rejected it, that they reached out to the prosecution and said, get us a deal. And the prosecution, after consulting with the families briefly and getting a negative response from at least two of those families, still turned around and, as you said, made a deal with the devil that gave him the best possible outcome for him. And for the love, all I can think of is these families and what they're dealing with right this minute. Their hearts are broken. Their souls are crushed by a decision that just compounds the pain.
Okay, let me understand what you just said, Dave Mack. You said they. Now, I believe you and I have discussed that we use proper names, not he, she, they. Okay, who reached out to who for a deal?
Brian Koberger's defense team reached out to Brian Thompson, the prosecutor of Latah County, and asked for a deal.
So, what does that mean to me? Every defense attorney drags up the hall at the courthouse wanting a deal, a sweet deal. And they start off with, hey, can I have straight probation? This guy's really, he's a really good guy. Yeah, that's how it always starts, right? And then they go up and they go up. So what? So what? They wanted a deal. That means nothing to me. Of course they want a deal. That's a given. They want a deal. I mean, so the defense asked for a deal. And so what? The state just bent over a barrel and said, go to it?
They said, take the death penalty off the table and we're in. And that is apparently what has happened. The guy was staring four murders, death penalty, firing squad. We've done shows about the possible ways of him being taken out if convicted. And after everything we've seen, it looks like at the finish line here, getting ready to go to trial, and they say, take the death penalty off the table and we'll sign off on it. And that is apparently what happened. I say apparently because I wasn't there or involved with any of the discussions. I can only go on what has actually transpired in the last 24 hours.
Everyone, let's take a listen to a little bit of what we know happened in the hours surrounding the murders of four Idaho students. Four students dead. And now I got to give this guy three hots and a cot for the rest of his life while he has the opportunity to make book and movie deals, have online girlfriends. Are you kidding? Listen.
Tell me exactly what's going on.
One of the roommates has passed out and she was drunk last night and she's not waking up.
Okay.
Oh, and they saw some man in their house last night. Yeah.
And are you with the patient? Okay, I need someone to keep the phone. Stop passing it around.
Can I just tell you what happened pretty much?
What is going on currently? Is someone passed out right now?
I don't really know, but pretty much at 4 a.m.
Okay, I need to know what's going on right now if someone is passed out. Can you find that out?
Yeah, I'll come. Come on, but we gotta go check. But we have to.
Joining me, longtime friend and colleague, Cold Case Investigative Research Institute founder and host of a new hit podcast, Zone 7, Cheryl McCollum, joining me. I've never heard anything like it in a case of this magnitude or any case at all, to completely disregard what the victims' families want because you're afraid to go to trial. Really? Because that's what other reason could there be to do this to the families of the victims? How could, I mean, if you're not there to help the crime victims, why are you there? Why don't you go get a job in a law firm and sit in a library and research all day? You know, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. If you can't do battle, get off the battlefield. I'm stunned, Cheryl.
Nancy, arguably, a quadruple homicide is going to be one of the most important cases of your career. How does each family not have a victim advocate in contact with them?
Put her up.
How?
Cheryl McCollum, frankly, pardon my Latin, but screw their careers. This is not about anybody's career. Screw that. This is about what is right and what is wrong and representing the victims. The victims don't want this. So why is it happening?
Nancy, it's unimaginable. And that's why I'm saying this was not taken in the breath that it should have been, that you're going to send somebody an email, that there was not a call made, that there was not an in-person meeting where everybody is together to understand what the offer was and whether or not it was going to be accepted or rejected as a group, as a whole. This happened to a group of people. It should be under every possible consideration that these moms and dads and siblings have a say here, period.
The infuriating letter that prosecutors send the families of the Idaho murder victims, informing them that there is a plea deal and nothing they can do about it. Okay, joining me, you know him well, Philip Dubay, high-profile defense attorney out of L.A. Dubay, I'm not arguing with you right now about the state versus the defense, the evidence. I'm talking to you about common courtesy, right? You cannot enter a plea deal without your client, the defendant, agreeing, can you?
No, of course not. It's his right to the plea. It's his right to the trial that he's giving up. And it must be voluntary. But what a lot of people don't know is that the law does not require the concurrence of victims or victims' next of kin in settlement negotiations or the outcomes of plea deals. They're to be looped in, advised as to what's happening, but they are not a party to the negotiations or the ultimate plea agreement. And as alienating as it might sound, it is simply not required. I think the only recourse that voters have right now is the ballot.
Hey, you know what, Dubé? You're right. There's nowhere in the law that says you have to coordinate your plea deal with the victim's family. Yeah, there's no law saying that. There's no common law, which is case law, stating that. It's neither statutory in the code, in the written letter of the law, or in the common law, which is case law. But in a murder case, I'm asking you a yes, no question, Dubé. When you enter a plea in any felony, name it, I don't care what it is, any felony, isn't it true, Dubé, that you must have the consent, the agreement, the cooperation of your criminal defendant? That is a yes, no, Dubé.
Yes.
So what that means is, while a criminal defendant set to plead guilty, who is guilty of murder, of any felony, it could be car theft, they must agree and cooperate. Not so for the violent crime victim's family. It doesn't matter what they think. Have you ever, Chris McDonough, in your life heard anything like the stunt, the double deal, the backstab that has gone on in this case with the victims' families, all opposed to this deal? Would you even consider it?
No. And in fact, you always want to have the cooperation of the family as you enter back into that courtroom. And to add, salt into the wound, how about restitution for the family? You know, I know what I've seen these families so many times. What are they thinking today, right, Nancy? How much did my child cost? Is that the question the prosecution's asking? And that's part of the deal? It's just a bad situation all around.
Now, it's very interesting. Guys, that's Chris McDonough speaking. He is former homicide detective who has worked over 300 hardcore homicides over his 25-year career plus more. He is the host of The Interview Room, where I found him on YouTube, to renowned author Howard Bloom joining me, the author of the definitive work on this case, When the Night Comes Falling, a requiem for the Idaho student murders. Howard, I'm in shock. I couldn't believe it when I heard there is a deal and the families disagree. Now, Howard, I wouldn't have liked it or agreed with it, even if the families had gone along with this. But I would bow to their decision because, of course, I defer to them. I can't believe the state has done this. I'm stunned. And I very rarely go against the state, because I believe prosecutors generally have reasons for what they do that we may not understand. Very often I question, well, why this count and not that count? Why that strategy? Why did you say that? But I know that they know ins and outs of the case that the public doesn't know, and they may very well have their reasons for what they do, but I don't see a reason for this.
I mean, state's behavior was at best cavalier and at worst, I agree with you, reprehensible. But what I think is interesting is why the defense at this point decide to make a deal. And what I'm hearing is about families too. Early on, Koberger had been approached by his attorneys about making a deal, and his mother was against it, dead set against it. She wanted to come to trial. Now that the trial was approaching, it looked like Koberger's parents were going to have to go on the stand. This was told to him. his mother would have to talk about the telephone call she got at 6 a.m. Idaho time, 9 a.m. in Pennsylvania, that went on for about an hour just after the murders. And she would have to say, what was going on there? Did she have any suspicions? His father was going to have to talk about the cross-country trip they took and what was discussed during that trip. And to protect his family, when this was presented to Koberger, Koberger finally was convinced by his lawyers that maybe he should make a deal. That's what I've been hearing.
Howard Bloom, do you think I care about that family, that they don't want to take the stand? So I don't care that Koberger's family doesn't want to take the stand. Do not care. They still have their son. They can visit him. He can write books. He can write letters. He can do FaceTime. He will be in their lives forever, whether they want him to be or not. I'm talking about what this has done to the victim's family. Remember them?
You're raising a non sequitur. The question is, how did this deal come about? How are they finally able to make a deal? I think, you know, the families of the victims are going to be victims forever. It's a tragedy. It's horrible. How did this come around that a deal was made? What did the prosecution see that they were willing to make this deal? Was it just about saving money? Are they that cynical for the state? Did they actually think they could lose this case? What was going on here? I think those are interesting questions, too.
You know, they've got DNA. They've got the defendant's DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, at the crime scene, on the sheath of the murder weapon, underneath a victim. And they're pleading? What? They don't want the bother of going to trial? All along, I have been listening to them in court. I've been watching everything they do. They seem like they were in it wholeheartedly. But now at the 11th hour, basically on the eve of trial, they take a plea that infuriates, that destroys the victims' families. Why? I cannot think of a single reason why. You know what? Let's have a little refresher. Joining us, Dr. Kendall Crowns, Chief Medical Examiner, Tarrant County, that's Fort Worth. Never a lack of business there. He is the esteemed lecturer at the Burnett School of Medicine, and he is a star of podcast Mayhem in the Morgue. Dr. Kendall Crowns, could you explain how these four young students with their lives before them at college, like, you know what I'm going through right now? With the twins trying to get in college, they're entering their senior year of high school right now. Which one is the best? Which one would help them? Which one would be better for each one of them? Which one is a safe campus? And when you get them there, you're like, oh, thank you, Lord in heaven. They're going to have a good life. This is all I can do to ensure them that they'll be educated and they'll be able to make their way in the world. They're not going to be digging a ditch for Pete's sake, hurting their back, breaking their limbs. And they're stabbed dead in their beds. Now evidence that one of the girls tried to run for her life and was stabbed on the stairwell. What happened physically to these victims, Dr. Kendall Crowns?
So each of the victims has multiple stab wounds about their body. And the problem with stab wounds is one stab wound isn't necessarily going to incapacitate you right away. So there will be kind of a running fight. The individuals will try and fight back. They may grab the knife in a last-ditch attempt to stop the stabbing, but they receive multiple stab wounds each. And that means each one of those stab wounds created pain and suffering that ultimately resulted in their death. And the one that got up and ran, that meant she was pursued through the hallway with the fear of this individual coming after her, and then finally getting up on her and then finishing her off by stabbing her again multiple times. So every one of them suffered quite a bit because stabbing cases are usually quite horrific and have a lot of violence associated with them.
Dr. Kendall Crowns, you really gave me the airbrushed version of that. A lot of pain. Yeah, I know there's a lot of pain. They're stabbed dead. They're practically somnambulant, half asleep, half awake. They can't breathe. Their lungs fill up with blood. There's stab wounds on their legs. All of this somehow deriving from Koberger's bizarre fetishes about raping women that are drugged, passed out, or asleep. What was their deaths? What were their deaths like?
So their deaths would be basically they're losing blood over a period of time. They've got the multiple stab wounds. They're bleeding internally. Their chest cavities are filling up with blood. If the lungs are involved, which I'm sure there were several of them that had the lungs involved, they're coughing up blood, re-swallowing it as they're slowly slipping into unconsciousness. In individuals where the chest cavity is compromised, it'll fill up with blood and it'll make it hard to breathe. And essentially you're drowning in your own blood at that moment.
Dr. Kimmel Crowns, you're absolutely correct. And I hope that when you are teaching all of those medical students at the Burnett School of Medicine, that you explain to them what crime victims live through at the time of their death. And it's not all clinical. Lives were snuffed out that night. And for what? To fulfill Brian Koberger's weird fantasies? How do we know about them? Because they were found on a search engine, raping women, asleep, passed out, drugged, incapacitated.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Joining me now, Joseph Scott Morgan, Professor of Forensics, Jacksonville State University, author of Blood Beneath My Feet on Amazon, and star of a hit series, Body Bags with Joe Scott Morgan. Joe Scott, everything that Dr. Kendall Crowns said is true, and more. What happened that night, Joe Scott?
This individual gained access to this house, Nancy. I truly believe in my heart of hearts, and no one will ever convince me otherwise, that he laid in wait. He had observed this house. He looked for points of entry. And then for whatever reason, at that particular time, immediately after Zanna had collected that food order, he decided to make entry. And he was purposed to do what he did. Ascending, I believe, to that top floor first, went in and attacked those two girls in that room. He attacked one to the point where she was deceased at the door and was blocking the ability for the other young lady to egress out of that room. So he's got them essentially trapped in there, and he's moving back and forth between them, perhaps. Wielding this knife, and this knife, for folks that haven't been around a K-bar, is very robust. I mean, it is a killing knife. As a matter of fact, developed by the Marine Corps, Nancy, they actually had a field manual that taught combat tactics in CQB, close quarter combat, with this knife. And this is the weapon of choice here, allegedly, that he wielded against both of them. One of the newest turns in this whole thing, back to Zanna, is that, you know, we were told wrongly by the coroner, I think 2 days afterwards, she gave a press conference or spoke to a reporter where she said that they all appeared to be asleep in their bed. No, this was a dynamic situation. Something drew her upstairs. And if now we are to believe what happened, Zanna was attacked on that staircase. And of course, we know that her boyfriend, Ethan, downstairs was equally attacked. We had heard a report earlier that not only may he have been stabbed, but also his throat had been slashed, an incised wound, which adds a completely different level to all of this. The brutality of this, you can't take the measure of it. You can in the morgue, obviously, but when you contextualize these bodies at the scene and you see the blood deposition and the struggle, maybe broken things, knocked over furniture, you get the full force of this. And you know what, Nancy? I'm so disappointed because I don't know if family will ever truly hear about this. I don't know that we'll ever know truly what happened that night in that environment unless he's compelled to allocute.
Come on, Mason, we gotta go check. But we have to. She's not going wrong. She's not waking up.
What is the address of the emergency?
1122 King Road.
Emergency then and now, as the victims' families reeling over a backdoor deal done without their consent, where Brian Koberger pleads guilty and escapes any possibility of the death penalty. Look, people are divided. Death penalty, no death penalty. But it should at least go to a jury. The victims' families should at least know it went to a jury. Then, win or lose, at least the state did everything it could possibly do. This as nightmarish scenarios play out about what Idaho killer Brian Koberger will now do since he has been spared the death penalty. Straight out to renowned psychologist specializing in forensic psychology, Dr. John Delatorre. Nothing will preclude him. You know, right now, of course, Dr. Delatorre, he, the devil, is gnashing his teeth and twitching his tail, rubbing his hands together in glee, because tonight, a deal with the devil has been made. A plea deal with Brian Koberger. It tastes like dirt in my mouth right now. Dirt. I never thought the state would do this. I thought remote possibility they might lose. But they would have gone down fighting. Sweaty, dirty, bloody, bruised, but fighting. That's what it means to be a trial lawyer. If you're not up for it, then get out of the ring. Throw in the towel. Nothing will prohibit Brian Koberger from lounging in his private cell, writing his online girlfriends, writing his memoirs, making money off his art. I almost feel like I'm going to be sick. Explain. Nightmarish scenarios spinning out in my mind about how he will be coddled. He will be treated like a hero behind bars.
I'm already sick, Nancy. This was done in the shadows, in the night. I mean, for what reason? I mean, all they got was the death penalty off the table. That's the only thing that this plea deal has done. So then why do it at all? If you're going to do it, you should have done it at the very, very, very beginning of all of this. But instead, now it seems the prosecution is either too sheepish or too cheap to actually want to engage in this trial. And that is the second offense, right? This is the secondary victimization of this entire family.
Cheryl McCollum, I hate thinking back on my fiance's murder. I don't like it. I try not to do it. When I go speak or in certain scenarios, I know I'm going to be asked and I'm prepared. I'm steeled. But when I think back, I know the prosecutors did all they could. I know that. And I knew nothing. I had never even been in a courtroom until I went and took that witness stand. But I know they did all they could. And that is what I promised to every victim I ever represented. I might lose, but you can know I will do everything I can do for you and your loved one that you lost. I will do it all within the bounds of ethics. I will do it all. Now, he, Koberger, will be immortalized. I mean, you know what? immortalized like Bundy. We're still talking about Ted Bundy and how brilliant he was. He was a psychopathic killer perv. That's what he was. And now Koberger will wear the crown.
What a disgusting twist that this person just destroyed these four beautiful children's lives, but saved his own. But Nancy, as you have said so many times, if you dance with the devil, he will lead. And trust me, Brian Koberger has not done this for any reason but a self-serving one.
Is she breathing?
No.
Okay.
You know, there's the old phrase, there ain't no justice, and that is how I feel tonight. There ain't no justice. At least for Pete's sake, take it to a jury. Let them decide. But the family instead gets this letter, quote, "We cannot fathom the toll this case has taken on your family." Really? Then why did you do a deal behind their backs? They told you they didn't want this, but you did it anyway. Brian Koberger now escapes the death penalty in a deal with the devil, and that devil would be Brian Koberger. To Philip Dubé joining me, veteran trial lawyer out of L.A., what many witnesses and victims want in a courtroom are answers. We'll never have that because you cannot force the defendant to elocute, speak, and explain in court. You may be able to keep them from taking an Alford plea, which means I'll take my punishment, but I'm never going to say I did it. You can withhold a plea deal if all they'll plea is by Alford. O-H-E-L-L-N-O. You will admit you did it in front of the victims. But you cannot force a defendant to allocute, speak, explain.
Depends on the terms of the plea deal. Absolutely you can. You can absolutely insist as a prosecutor that he take to the microphone and explain step by step everything that he did on the night of the homicides. He can explain what motivated him, how he obtained the deadly weapon, how he lied in wait, and how he then later disposed of the weapon, and how he then later tried to reorder a sheath, and how he freaked out when he found out that DNA was found on that sheath. It can all come in through an allocution. There is no prohibition against it. And frankly, I don't think that this is the bolt from
the blue. But if the defendant insists he will not allocute,
then
he cannot be forced to. Exactly.
Then there's no deal.
Like, let's just say a witness gets a subpoena. The witness comes into court. If the witness refuses to testify, unless they've got a Fifth Amendment right of some sort or some privilege, they can be forced to testify or they can be sent to jail until they and give them time to think about it. If the defendant doesn't want to allocute, he may lose a deal, but he cannot be forced to allocute. He cannot be forced to explain to anybody anything. And where this leaves me straight out to Dr. John Dellatore is the victims never knowing what happened. I know what happened when Keith was murdered. It's been all twisted up in the media, but I know what happened. Keith left a construction site. He was a geology student. He left a construction site on a summer job to go get everybody else soft drinks because it was a remote site. And when he pulled back in, he was gunned down. He was driving the company truck in the boss's truck. And a disgruntled employee came up and opened fire on the truck, and it killed him. He was shot 5 times in the face, the neck, the back, and the head. That's what happened. I know that. There was a trial. They will never have that peace, Dellatore. They will never, such peace as it is, they'll never have that.
No, and we're not going to talk about closure and, you know, all different kinds of experts can all talk about incels and all different kinds of nonsense. But what the family wants is what's actual and factual. They don't want closure so much as they want the information. They want to know the answer. Why? Why did you do this? Why did you do this then? Why did you choose my family? Why did you choose to do this thing and hurt so many people?
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
an eerie, a haunting selfie emerges. Oh, there we go. Brian Koberger dressed like Ted Bundy. Mr. Button-down Oxford shirt. I've got a black hoodie, and I don't take freaky selfies in it. Joining me in All-Star panel, too, Joseph Scott Morgan, professor of forensics, Jacksonville State University, and star of Body Bags with Joe Scott Morgan. Joe Scott, I'm stunned. I'm reeling. I feel numb. When I heard this, I felt like I got kicked in the stomach. At first, I thought it was a joke.
I felt the same way. I think I got like 5 texts simultaneously, including from my mother. This group of people that he claimed that he was part of relative to the world of criminology, where he spent all of his time as an undergraduate, master's degree level student, studying under people. And now he's gone out to Washington State. And the tool that he created in order to question people with, trying to dig into their lives in prison, you know, relative to thinking about crimes. Nancy, he's now officially going to be part of that world. And I bet you my next paycheck that upon arrival at the state penitentiary, he's going to have mail. He's going to have mail from the same group of people that he claimed that he was going to be a part of. And they're going to have questionnaires for him. People are going to want to come and interview him, and they're going to do it under the guise of academic research. It's not an enjoyable thing to be in general pop, but I'm telling you, he, just like BTK, when he allocuted, you could see in his eyes that he enjoyed that, recalling every single detail. Now, this guy's going to be given a forum, and I can tell you there are 4 voices that are silenced permanently. And to even maybe a greater extent, his family, these families' voices have been silenced as well, because obviously their requests were falling on deaf ears.
You know, Cheryl, Cheryl McCollum and I have been through a lot together. We came up together in the system. Inner city Atlanta, one of the murder capitals of the world. Cheryl McCollum, founder, director of Cold Case Research Institute, and star of a hit podcast, Zone 7. Cheryl, think it through. You have a boy and a girl. I have a boy and a girl. Okay? Follow this through to its logical conclusion. One of them, and I hate to do this to you, one of them is murdered brutally in their sleep. You never get answers. And then spin it out, Cheryl. Spin it out. As I like to say, follow it through to its logical conclusion. And then you find out. You just happen to be looking online and bam, notice, alert. The killer is going to be zoomed in to a big conference where he's a star. And he's going to be explaining the inner workings of the mind of a killer. He's the star. He's not getting payment. His payment is going to, let's just pretend, his girlfriend that he's made behind bars, his pen pal. He's the star. People applaud for his speech. I mean, why don't we all just get down, bow down to the devil? Because that is what is happening. Because nobody had the backbone to take this thing to trial and try the damn case, win or lose. I don't get it. Can you? Because you know this is going to happen, right? You know. I mean, I've had to look at Alex Murdaugh's shirtless selfies, for Pete's sake. He has a tablet behind bars. This will happen. I don't know how it's going to happen. Just the same way Didi gets a cell phone behind bars he's not supposed to have.
Sure.
Like that. It's going to happen, Cheryl.
Let's talk reality. Reality is, he thinks by taking the death penalty off the table, he has saved his life. Maybe.
So what? That he was a complete loser in every sense, destroying his own family, his parents, his sisters, the business, his education. He had everything handed him on a silver platter, and this is what he does. I don't care about him. What I'm telling you about the victims' families.
Correct. And that's my point. They were never going to get justice. Even with the death penalty, if he were put to death, that is not in any way comparable to what they lost. It's just more death. It's more sadness.
Tonight, our prayers with the families of the Idaho murder victims. Nancy Grace signing off. Good night, friends.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.